If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Grab your pitchfork, light your torch, and get ready for inciting a riot. Conventional thinking has been warned, because we're going to gather, and we're going to march, and we're going to blow its f***ing house down.
Hello, rioters, and welcome back to Inciting a Riot, the podcast. I would be your left-wing dirt-worshipping host, Firelight. Today, you are probably wondering why you're hearing from me. It isn't a Tuesday. We just put out an episode. What's going on here? Well, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, otherwise known as the IPCC, just put out what they're calling the Sixth Assessment Report. This is a regularly scheduled report put together by an international group of climate scientists, specifically regarding climate change, climate disasters, and the science surrounding it. You have probably seen quite a lot of headlines and a lot of catastrophizing tweets here and there, and I thought that it was important to discuss this matter in front of an audience of pagan people, folks who consider themselves pretty in tune with the earth, people who find climate change to be a matter of not just political importance, but of spiritual importance, and really try to stay informed. However, when so much is happening in the news, when so many things are going on, and with as big as this report is, it can be difficult to figure out what the important information is, how alarmed should you be, how alarmed shouldn't you be, and what you as an individual person can do. I mean, some of these topics are really, really, really big, and the stakes are really big. So I brought back good friend of the show and previous guest, Dr. Sam Montano, whose new book is making headlines everywhere, Disasterology. I thought, who better than Dr. Montano, the disasterologist herself, to come back to the show and break down what this IPCC report says, what it's about, what the ramifications are, and what you at home should be doing about it, if anything. It's a little bit shorter of a discussion. I'm considering this a bonus episode. You are still going to have another episode in your feeds on your regularly scheduled time. But given the sort of the urgent nature of this matter, of this discussion, and of this news headline, I thought it was important to bring you this chat earlier than would be normal. Anyways, enough from me. Please enjoy this. I do hope that you'll forgive me. It is not as beautifully edited as I normally would try to have. In fact, you can probably hear Eggsy panting in the background. We just got back from a walk. So this is a slapdash episode put together, but I hope you'll appreciate it in the spirit in which it was intended. Okay, here's the episode. Dr. Sam Montano, welcome back to Inciting a Riot. How are you?
I am good. Thank you for having me back.
I can imagine it has been a very busy time for you, not only because since the last time you were on the show, your book has come out. Disasterology is out.
It is.
So I have a really original question for you. What's it like to write a book?
It is exhausting, and I'm so glad it's done.
I'm so jealous. One more month. One more month. And I will be on the other side of it with you. Okay, so I wanted to bring you back on the show because we just had a pretty big drop of information come into the public sector from what's called the IPCC. And the audience for this show are, you know, dirt worshiping, pagany, spiritual, woo woo folks who are really, really into discussions of natural science and appreciation for the earth and want to be informed about stuff related to climate change and ecological disasters and things like that. But sometimes some of this information is really big and really dense and really hard to digest. Just like the IPCC report that just came out, which is what, like 2,300 pages, something like that?
Yeah, it's well over 2,000. Very long. Yes, it's very long.
So I wanted to have the disasterologist herself come back on and maybe give us just kind of a quick and dirty rundown of one, what the IPCC is, and, you know, why this is important. So for folks who don't know, what does IPCC stand for? What is this?
Yeah, so the IPCC stands for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is a group that was created by the United Nations in 1988. And their purpose is to gather put out every 7 years or so a report that essentially is a summary for policymakers about the state of the climate research. So since the last report that came out in 2013, we've had a ton of new research on climate change. The data that we have access to, the models that climate scientists use have advanced dramatically. And so it was time for over 200 scientists from around the world to come together, read through, again, all of this research that's been published. I think there's over 14,000 studies that are cited in this report. Go through all of that, kind of synthesize the findings of that work, and put it into this multiple thousands of pages to make it, quote, more digestible for us to read through, and, you know, provide a summary for policymakers so that they can be making hopefully better decisions about climate change.
So obviously, when a big info dump like this happens, you know, reporters try to comb through it as quickly as possible so that they can do be the first to get the headline. Whatever the headline's going to be out of it, they want to be the first to get that. But I feel like with an info dump like this, we're going to have a lot of headlines coming out for months, if not years. People looking back and saying, oh, you know, in retrospect, this was the important part of this. Overall, though, why is the IPCC information, why is this report important? Why should we as regular folks care about this information?
Yeah, well, I think there's a few reasons. One, when you are dealing with a topic as broad as climate change, having the opportunity to bring so many different researchers from all over the world, from all different disciplines together to actually sort through all of that research is a very necessary thing that needs to happen kind of academically. Another major purpose for this, and I suppose the primary purpose, is to provide this information to policymakers. So when we're thinking about what the findings of this report are most directly going to affect, it'll affect some media coverage. It'll affect maybe how some people think about about climate change. But really, ideally, what we need it to do is influence how policymakers, particularly in powerful countries like the United States, China, India, are thinking about climate change and understanding what they need to be doing differently to address climate change. So really, this is kind of laying the groundwork for another climate change conference that is happening later this year in Glasgow, which is going to kind of be some renegotiations about what targets we're hitting and how we're hitting those targets. And going back to issues brought up with the Paris Climate Agreement and trying to kind of reconcile all of these different goals that are out there and chart a path to kind of hopefully the least amount of destruction when it comes to climate change.
So I know sort of the big headline out of the last Paris Climate Accords. The last Paris Climate Agreement was, you know, most of the countries around the world had sort of an informal arrangement to basically do whatever it takes so that we don't hit, what was it, 2 degrees Celsius of warming? Is that right?
Yeah. So, yeah. The Paris Agreement, the kind of current commitments that stand from the Paris Agreement, put the goal at 2 degrees Celsius, which is about 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So that was that goal. However, the real goal that it should have been, or that like the most ideal goal here, is 1.5 degrees Celsius, which is the number that many island nations and other particularly vulnerable nations around the world argued is the kind of level of warming that they felt if they passed that, it would put the survival of their entire countries at risk. So 2 degrees, 1.5 degrees, these kind of sound like small differences, but they're actually kind of enormous differences between these two. The point is that we need to keep that degree as low as possible to prevent as much damage as possible.
So I'm an idiot, so correct me if I'm wrong here, because when you're talking about such a small change in temperature, it sounds like, oh, this is the difference between me having a 70 degree Fahrenheit day or a 73, you know, 74 degree day. Both sound pleasant. One is moderately warmer than the other. I probably won't notice the difference. So here in the Midwest, that very kind of American-centric view of climate that we have, because what happens in the U.S. tends to, for some reason, become what the news is and become what the story is. But if I understand it correctly, we're not talking about me in the Midwest having a slightly warmer day in the summer. We're talking about areas that typically see freezing temperatures warming up to no longer being freezing, and therefore all of this ice is now melting and going into the ocean. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of. So one thing that I think is important to understand about climate change science is that there are kind of these different scenarios, and this is a huge focus of the IPCC report. So they're kind of depending on if we have that 1.5 or that 2, 2.5, 3, whatever number it is, there are these kind of different scenarios that we can model out to try and predict what those consequences look like. Mm. One new thing that was really emphasized in this report was taking a more regional perspective. So traditionally, when we have been talking about global temperature increase, then talking about the number of feet of sea level rise that we're dealing with a global average, which is useful in terms of kind of general science communication, but it's actually really misleading, particularly for those of us that do disaster research like I do, because it kind of obscures those regional differences. So just because, you know, we'll have a global average of 2 feet of sea level rise, well, that can mean 1 foot of sea level rise in one part of the country, and it could mean 3 feet in another part of the country, right? So so scenarios matter, and then also kind of the actual regional impacts are going to vary. So in terms of the scenarios, the IPCC report lays out these different scenarios, which kind of increasingly get very, very scary. You have kind of these high-end scenarios that I describe it as like, it's the kind of stuff science fiction writers write, right? You're talking about a planet that is just completely broken down. There would be huge parts of the world that are uninhabitable. There would be heat waves happening constantly, just, you know, not any place that we want to be living. And so those are for those scenarios that are like over 5 degrees Celsius. Then there are the middle of the road scenarios, which are kind of equally terrifying in some ways. Like Earth is still like it does not, like, living here does not seem like how it is now, right? It's just one disaster after another. The, you know, major disasters that we've had of the past 5 years are kind of nothing to deal with. And then there are these, you know,
I hate to stop you there, but that seems like a big statement to throw out there, because we've had some massive catastrophe. I mean, we're going through it right now. I mean, we are in a massive catastrophe.
Yes.
The West Coast is on fire. I mean, there's multiple places around the world that are just kind of on fire and have been for like a month or more. And no end to that, no end is in sight. So it seems like a big thing to say. So I want to pause and give that some breathing room, that what we've experienced in the recent past, which feels like we're in disaster world, that's nothing compared to what might come.
Yes, this is why I'm very stressed out all the time. So, but here we're getting to better news. So
she's replaced her camelback with she went to go get the box of wine. She just pulled the bag out and stuck it into her camelback and is just walking around all day with her rosé. Gotcha. Okay.
But then, you know, we do have these lower scenarios, which, like I said, are still bad, right? They're still bad. But they are still significantly less bad than these runoff scenarios, right? And so, as we're thinking about this, it is important to know that we're dealing with this range. No matter where we fall in that range, it's still going to be bad. But the question is, how bad is it going to be? And that is really ultimately the kind of point that people should take from this report, which is that we have agency over where we fall in this scale, right? The climate change is not this switch that we can just flip on and off. We've got to work on it. And the more we do to lower our emissions, the better off that we will be in the future. And also keep in mind, as an emergency management researcher here, I also want to point out that not only are we needing to do things to lower our emissions to deal with climate change itself, but there is also a lot that we can be doing to adapt to these changes as they happen, right? We don't need to have every hurricane be a complete disaster every time it comes ashore, right? There are things we can do, like very tangible things like changing building codes, doing more to make sure people are evacuating, putting better warnings out, right? There's this very long list of things that we can do to adapt to these changes as they happen in our environment.
So turning back to the IPCC report for a moment, you are an emergency manager. You teach other people emergency management. You do it professionally. What are you looking for? What are you hearing? What are your red flags? And what are your, you know, what's freaking you out? What's sending you to your camelback of rosé in this report? But is there anything in this report that you're like, okay, this isn't as bad as I thought it was going to be? Okay, so from your expression, I'm going to guess it's all the first one. But yeah. What do you look for? Like, what should I be freaking? I feel like it's like, you know, I'm on the plane and I'm experiencing turbulence, but I shouldn't be freaking out until I see the flight staff freaking out. Which part of this report are you freaking out about?
You know, honestly, there isn't really a particular point that has freaked me out yet. I'm still slowly reading through this. There is not, but. The reason for that is that I study this every single day, right? Sure. And the findings that are in here don't come from new research. This comes from research that has been put out over the past 5-10 years. And because of this, you know, there are these studies coming out regularly that are updating our knowledge of climate change, updating how we're thinking about this. And in that sense, this report doesn't have a lot of new things, right? Like, the kind of fundamental things in this report are all things that we have known for a long time. what has changed is the urgency with which this report was written, the kind of strength in the language, the certainty of the science that is in this report. That is different than in the past. But there is a sustainability scientist, Dr. Kimberly Nicholas, who works in Sweden. And she has kind of a great saying about climate change that I think is kind of a useful mantra, if you will, which is, it's warming, it's us, we're sure, it's bad, we can fix it. And I think it's that we can fix it part that we really, really need to be focused on here, right? We know this is happening, like it is bad, right? There is no getting around that. We're already experiencing the consequences of climate change across the US, around the world. Like this is happening, we're locked in, and it's up to us and the policy decisions that our leaders make to fix this and turn the ship around, make it not as bad as it could be.
So I want to ask then, or at least I want to just really get that Sharpie out and draw that line for the listener at home who might be hearing. So what this report is telling us and what recent research has told us is that these disasters that we were just talking about, you know, these wildfires, these, you know, once in a century wildfires that seem to be coming, you know, once a year, once every couple of years now, these heat waves, these once in a generation earthquakes, once in a generation, this, that, or the other. These things that are starting to happen regularly, these are products of man-made climate change.
Yes, that is a factor in them. Yeah. So, okay. So when we think about disasters, there's the hazard, right? The actual hurricane, the actual wildfire. And then there is us, right? And it's when that's interacting with us that it leads to there being a disaster. So climate change is affecting that hazard part of the equation. And one actually more developed piece in this report is the science of extreme weather attribution, which this might be like a little bit nerdy, but bear with me, it's important. So a number of scientists, including a scientist in Europe, Dr. Freddy Otto, has created this method for studying particular specific disasters that have happened. So when there's the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest, they take that data and they compare it to what temperatures would have looked like in a world without climate change, pre-industrial revolution. And they say, how much more likely was this heat wave in a world with climate change as compared to what the temperature would have been in pre-industrial times? And by doing this really rapid research in the wake, it not only shows the extent of the influence of climate change on these events, which for something like the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest, they found that heat wave essentially would not have happened in a world without climate change. That is really, really important for not only for science to show how we're advancing in our knowledge of these different events, but it's also so critical in shaping the media narrative when these events happen, because her and other researchers are able to do this so quickly. They're able to get the findings of these studies out while the heat wave is still in the news cycle. So we can much more directly connect climate change to these heat waves, which helps elevate climate change in these news cycles as they're, you know, covering these disasters that are happening. But perhaps even more importantly than that, this really potentially could lay the groundwork for huge changes in legal responsibility for disasters when they happen. If we have real evidence that climate change is at the heart of some of these disasters, there is a potential path through the legal system to hold fossil fuel companies accountable, to hold other individuals accountable for these disasters when they happen. And, you know, given how litigious our culture is, that could be really, really powerful to helping to not only get compensation for people who have been affected, but to also have there be some real accountability for the companies that have gotten us to this point.
It's interesting that you bring up the possibility of litigation against oil companies. Oil companies being a pretty big contributor to climate change. You know, we're kind of seeing this in real time right now. We both have a week where the IPCC report is dominating the headlines, but also a week where we have people protesting the Line 3 oil pipeline running through, what is it, Minnesota, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of odd that IPCC is happening and like there's practically no coverage about Line 3 except in your corner of the internet and then in like some very small woo-woo ecological minded corners of the internet. And it feels like those two worlds are weirdly separated. Why is that?
Yeah, it's tough. I am a person who totally has a foot in kind of both of those worlds. My background was in activism, in climate activism, and now obviously as a researcher, my foot is in the science world too. And there is a disconnect to a sense, but I do also think that, you know, we're all kind of moving in a similar direction here. Mm-hmm. The methods that we're using to get there are very different, right? Physically going and trying to stop a pipeline, turn a pipeline off, shut down a oil refinery. So, right, all of those more on the ground direct actions are in many ways just as important as mm-hmm. helping to write an IPCC report. These are, the issue with climate change is that it is so big. Mm. And the people who are in positions to do something about climate change are so powerful that it does take everybody putting pressure on those systems, whether that's through direct action, through science, through policy negotiations, through the legal system. All of these are completely valid ways of trying to approach this problem.
I want to ask because you bring up a really good point. It is so big. It's so big. There's a couple of points that I want to bring up, though. The statistic that you hear tweeted in a lot of pithy tweets is that, okay, you can do all of your recycling of your straws and you can do your, you can switch to renewable this, that, or the other, but 70% of climate change is attributed to 100 companies. One, is that true? And two... when so much of the blame seems to rest on big giant corporations, but also you're told if we do not change our ways, we are all in imminent doom. What's just like Joe and Jill? Like what we doing? What are regular people supposed to do about any of this other than cower in fear?
Sure. Don't cower in fear. fun to start with.
I don't know. I bought this bunker. See?
Great.
I dug this hole and I plan on cowering in there. It's a real good cowering spot.
Yeah, some days. No, look, it's all of the above, right? I think everybody wants there to be like one simple answer to what we do, and that just doesn't exist. So everyone's going to have to get over it and recognize that this is a really complex problem, which means it's going to have a complex solution, right? So yeah, you can like go around the world and play a game of who is most responsible for what is happening. And sure, you can lay a lot of this at the feet of BP and Exxon and Chevron. You can also lay a lot of this at the feet of US politicians. You can lay this at the feet of China, right? There are a lot of people and countries and politicians who are, I would argue, kind of most responsible for what is happening. At the same time, myself living in the United States, I have a much larger carbon footprint, even as somebody who is like aware of what's happening, as compared to a six-year-old child living in a developing country somewhere, right? So there are different levels of responsibility here. And what I think it is important to challenge people who are in decision-making positions and who are in powerful positions and bring the fight directly to them. at the same time, it's also useful and practical to reflect on our own actions and make sure that we are doing what we can to minimize our carbon footprints, but also to use the skills and the talents and resources that we have to contribute to the fight or contribute to the climate movement. And that can look very different for different people. If you are, you know, somebody with a podcast, for example, bringing on climate experts to talk about these issues is like a great thing that you can do. Congratulations, gold star. If you are somebody who, you know, is an artist, make art about climate change. If you're a writer, write about climate change, right? If you're a researcher, study it. There's all of these different things that we can be doing kind of day to day to contribute to this. And that doesn't always look like, you know, not using a plastic straw, right? There are some bigger issues at play here. And if you are somebody who lives in a country like the United States, where we do have more political power than other parts of the world, then using that political power, trying to leverage that as best you can for the benefit of everyone is our responsibility.
So it sounds like, you know, excluding billionaires who are basically, companies in and of themselves, practically excluding massive corporations, just the average person living an average life. It sounds like what I'm hearing is that do what you can, take a look at your own carbon footprint, your own contributions, and see what you could do to maybe contribute to the overall goodness going on. Give yourself a break if you cannot live the greenest, crunchiest, back to nature life as possible. You know, that you doing all of the things is not going to fix it. So give yourself a break. But it does sound like, yes, the average person doing something is still better, especially here in the West, where we are so, you know, the United States specifically, where we are such an affluent nation. And I don't think that people quite realize the privilege that we hold. You know, we do consume quite a bit more than the average person in another country, for example. So it does sound like there's some things to do. Are we all about to die? Because it feels like, depending on which headline I read, like we're all dead in the next 5 to 10 years. So like, your face is not helping me here, Dr. Montana.
Yeah.
I said that question as a joke. And I started the question as a joke, and I finished the question thinking maybe it wasn't a joke because of your face. So are we all dying, and should I be getting on the next Jeff Bezos ship to Mars?
No, Mars is a much more difficult place to live than Earth. are we all about to die? All of us? No. Are there people who are going to die in climate-related disasters in the next, you know, months, years? Yeah, there are. And that is, you know, there's a lot of space between an increased number of disasters and the, you know, complete human extinction, right? We're not near complete human extinction. That's not what we're talking about here. That's not what the IPCC report is reflecting at all. But, you know, this is a very, you know, real reality for a lot of people around the world. And that's really where the urgency of the report comes in. And, you know, I will say too, that this is hard, right? None of us have ever lived through the climate crisis before. It's hard to know how to respond to something like this. It's not something we've ever experienced before. We're all kind of figuring it out as we go. And it's okay to have this wide-ranging emotions about it, right? There are, you know, some days where I look at this and I am just like filled with despair that this is happening. And then there are other days where I look at this and I'm like, let me make a meme about this to deflect some of that. There are other days.
You have some mad meme skills. Just
thank you.
Some
I'm very
wicked
proud.
Meme skills.
But then there's other days where I see the work that activists are doing around the country. I see policy, or I see elected officials being elected who are running on climate platforms. You see something like the IPCC report come out. And honestly, the IPCC report came out and I wasn't sure how I'd feel about it, but it came out and the next day I was super motivated to get to work and start working even harder and doubling down our efforts on this, right? We know what we need to do. We just need to do it. And that is where we all do have some influence over what this future looks like, right? Things are not completely set in stone here. There is a lot of room to change the direction we're headed in.
So what are some action items for Joe and Jill non-billionaire? What can I be doing other than, you know, get rid of my straws and go buy a Tesla or whatever?
Sure. Go ahead. Do all of that. Number one, especially if you're in the United States, is to vote, and not only vote in presidential elections, but vote locally. There are policies at that local and state level that are hugely influential over climate change, over our risk in our local communities. That's where a lot of the policy changes related to climate adaptation are happening at that local and state level. So engaging more in local politics is really huge. The other major thing that people can be doing is joining local climate groups, but really any kind of local community groups that are working on issues related to climate change. I mean, you know, we focus on disasters here because that's what I study, but, you know, there are conservation groups, various types of groups that are looking at wetland restoration. There are groups dealing with fire ecology or forest ecology, you know, all of these different groups that exist that are kind of working on issues related to climate change that could use your talent and your support. We know that, you know, building community is one of the most important things that we can do to create communities that are more flexible and ready to go through these ups and downs. So those are, you know, I mean, those are tangible things that we can be doing. And I will say every single time, I would rather you use a plastic straw next time you go to Starbucks if it means that you're on your way to the polls to vote, right? That's probably for you going to have the bigger impact. So, you know, any and all of the above that you do is better than nothing.
I just want to add, there's a piece of this that I feel like we're saying, but I kind of want to say it directly. I feel like people just need to give themselves a little bit of a break and realize that if you are focused on one disaster or trying to figure out how you can minimize harm somewhere, it's okay to not freak out about something happening somewhere else. When you see news like Line 3, when you see the wildfires in California, when you see X, Y, or Z, and you see people on Twitter or see people on social media running around screaming, why aren't you outraged about this catastrophe? And it's like, well, I'm concerned with this catastrophe over here, and I only have so much bandwidth. I mean, as somebody who has had to have a lot of bandwidth because you deal with disaster professionally, do you have any advice for those of us that are just kind of new to the constant outrage, like how you give yourself a little bit of a break there?
Yeah, look, you are not going to fix everything single-handedly. It's just not going to happen. So just forgive yourself for that and focus on what is in front of you. Help others as you are able to, but saying goes, you have to put your own oxygen mask on first before you can help others. And sometimes that absolutely does mean logging off the internet and not looking at the latest disaster footage that is coming out. And it does mean kind of taking things slow, right? Climate change, this is like a battle that we are going to be fighting for the rest of our lives, right? This is not going away anytime soon. And so it's a marathon. You've got to pace yourself here. And, again, kind of recognize where your skill sets, where your interests, where your talents best fit in. I'll recommend two things kind of for more information if people want to check it out. So I mentioned her earlier, but Dr. Kimberly Nicholas, she actually just put out a book earlier this summer called Under the Sky We Make. She's a sustainability scientist, and she really goes through kind of step by step all of the things that we can be doing to mitigate climate change itself. And it's in a kind of a really easily accessible reading for people who want to look at that, even if you don't have a climate background. It's still something you can kind of pick up and jump into pretty easily. And then the other person who I always find immense comfort in reading is Marianise Hegler. She is the co-host of a podcast called Hot Take. They also have a newsletter. She's a climate writer, and she writes really beautifully kind of about the experience of watching climate change unfold. She talks a lot about using your talents that you have to address the climate crisis in whatever way you can, and has a lot of powerful essays that I think can really help kind of help you process this entire thing.
Real quick, while I have you here, I just want to ask one question about COVID.
Sure.
Just generally speaking, while we're talking about how freaked out should I be about things, how freaked out should I be about the direction of COVID cases here in the United States? Dr. Montana.
Well, once again, things are not great.
Because I see Dr. Montana, I see these maps. And they're just getting more red. Mm-hmm. And I think red's bad. I think red's bad. And it's all just getting more red. And see, I thought I did what I was supposed to do. I wore a mask for a year, and then I got got some shots. And I thought we were gonna be done soon. I was wrong about that, I think.
Some folks had a different plan for us.
But I do actually have a legit question here, because what we were all told was once we start hitting the magical threshold of 70% people with a shot in their arm, we're going to start hitting herd immunity, and then life can start resuming. And allegedly, in recent weeks, we were told that 70% of the adult population, now I guess I think I'm starting to answer some of my own question here. But 70% of the adult population has had at least one shot here in the United States, and yet cases are going up. I'm thinking elderly, disabled, and children here might, plus the unvaccinated, the unvaccinated adults who could get the shot, plus all the other groups. What's going on here?
Yeah. Okay. So first thing, right, 70% of the full population. So we're not there yet in the United States.
I thought we were. Is that not right? Didn't the Biden administration just put out like a whole thing where it was like, oh no, we finally hit our July 4th goal like a month late?
I think I'm worried I'm wrong now, but I think that was just for adults.
Right. Yes.
Can we Google? Okay. That's yes. Just for adults, right? And also I think that was only at least one shot.
Yeah. Oh, August. Well. Yes. August 2nd. It came out 70% of COVID vaccine milestones for adults, a month behind. So that was one shot in the arm of adults who could get vaccinated. Right. Allegedly have one shot at least.
Right. So some people are needing another shot. I don't know what the exact numbers are off the top of my head. And then we have kids who aren't eligible yet. So we're not quite there yet. My thinking on this is that the CDC needs to lower the age that can get shots. I think that's what's going to bring us closer to that number. And especially as schools are planning on reopening in person, I mean, I'm sure everybody is kind of watching this unfold across the country. Again, similar to climate change here, there's kind of a range of things that we could be doing here that we're not really doing, right? So putting back in actual mask mandates, not only generally, but specifically for kids that are going to school, that's going to stop, help stop the spread. Doing what we can to battle that misinformation machine that has emerged surrounding the vaccine, but also really targeting people who are kind of more persuadable about the vaccine, right? There are the people who you are never, ever going to persuade to go and get a vaccine, but there are a lot of people who are middle of the road, who maybe just need a ride to CVS, who maybe just haven't had time to go do it, haven't been able to take off work, people who just need somebody to talk them through the process, right? Those are the kind of persuadable people who we could really reach if there are more kind of community level outreach programs that are done across the country. And then getting the kids vaccinated is the next huge step.
Well, thank you for sure. for hopping on sort of last minute. Everything going on, I thought, you know, I don't know a lot, but I know people who do know a lot. So I wanted to talk to the disasterologist herself about this very important report, about sort of the direction of all of the various catastrophes going on right now. I think personally, my barometer for how bad is COVID getting is, are superhero movies still pushing back their dates? And as of today, the answer is yes. Because we did get confirmation that Venom 2 was now pushed back a month. And I was like, oh, we're screwed. we're starting this again.
We are somehow.
So which brand of toilet paper are you planning on hoarding? Is just.
Everything old is new again.
Do you have a Costco membership, and are you about to abuse it? My real last question for you here is there anything at all giving you joy right now? Anything, just anything at all, just culturally, personally, memally?
Yes, I've been out in the garden a lot. My tomato plants are starting to finally produce tomatoes. I don't know what they've been waiting for, but things are happening there. You know, that's about it. Those tomatoes, really.
Dr. Montana's tomatoes. All of our future hopes and dreams are resting on Dr. Montana's tomatoes. Well, thank you. I hope they're good. Because I'm a little terrified. Just a little bit more than I was an hour ago. So this is great. Oh, well, thank you so much, Dr. Montano. Your book, Disasterology, is out right now. For folks that want to get in touch with you, find out more about what you're doing, where can they do that?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is Sam L. Montano. And then you can also find my website, which is disaster-ology.com.
All right, Dr. Montano, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, writers, that's going to do it here for us today. I guess this is episode 176, Inciting an IPCC Riot. Links to both Dr. Montano's information as well as the resources that she mentioned during the show are going to be on the show notes at incitingariot.com. If you appreciate this show and you want to support it, there are a number of ways to help. You can consider liking and sharing the show on social media. You could also rate the show 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to download shows. Literally any review helps bump us up in the algorithm. So if you like the show, you're already on your phone, you're already at your computer, take a quick second to go into the app that you're using to listen to it and just see if you can rate it. And if you can, maybe see if you can leave a review for it. Literally just in a emoji is fine. Literally any commentary helps with engagement in the algorithm and helps bump us up. If you would like to do a little bit more, you can help keep the show free and producing on a regular basis by chipping in whatever you can. This can take the form of a single one-time donation. You can buy me a coffee. Links for that are in the show notes. Or you can join my Patreon on a monthly basis. Patrons receive additional audio and video content, as well as archived episodes. Every now and then I get emails saying, hey, where are episodes 1 through 98? Those are archived, and they are being slowly released on Patreon. They are bad. They are really bad. They're not anything you want to listen to, but if... I mean, they get better, but if you want to listen to them, they are, the archived episodes are part of one of the tiers on Patreon. There's also a private Discord server and monthly chats with special guests. You can do all of that at patreon.com/incitingprojects. We are just a few weeks away from the release of my debut book, The Dabbler's Guide to Witchcraft. You can pre-order that at bit.ly/Dabbler's Guide. There are ebook versions, there's paperback versions, and there's even an audiobook version by me. Anyways, I'm going to let you all go. Thank you so much for joining me for this very special episode of Inciting a Riot. Thank you again to my guest, Dr. Montano. I hope that this helps. Please let me know if you like these kind of shows. If you want to email me about this episode or anything else, you can do that at firelyte@incitingariot.com. Email me. Let me know what you thought of this, what you think of the climate catastrophe, generally speaking. I'd like to hear from you. If you would like to connect with me on social media, I'm pretty much at Inciting Riot on all forms of media. I'm going to leave you now, but as always, I will leave you with love and light. Firelight.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.